it was a competition I really wanted to win. You know, it was, I felt like it was designed for people like me.
If you lead an interesting life, good pictures will happen.
Oh, nice. You might well be my sexiest sounding guest.
Go somewhere you've never been before and take a camera.
We had this gorgeous Mediterranean light just flowing in.
Which Asda were you in?
Dartford.
Very nice.
Your first 10,000 pictures are your worst. Let's sit down, let's have a cup of tea.
Welcome to the show. Folks, thank you once again for joining me and welcome to another episode of the Standout Photography Show with me, Matthew Walker, where, as always, it is my honour and privilege to interview some of the finest working photographers in the world, to unpack their systems, workflows, and find out what enables them to perform consistently at the very top of their professions. My guest today is the wonderful Philip Lee Harvey. In his own words, Philip is a location photographer for the travel, tourism, and advertising sector. But that title alone is extremely modest. His work has taken him to some of the most inhospitable and demanding destinations throughout the world, working in environments ranging from Antarctica to the Sahara Desert. He is the winner of the prestigious Travel Photographer of the Year Award, and is also listed in Lerz's archive as one of the top 200 advertising photographers in the world. It is a real honour, and I'm very excited to have him here on the show. So please, without further ado, here is my guest, Philip Lee Harvey. So without further ado, Philip Lee Harvey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks for the opportunity of the interview.
Absolute pleasure. So, Philip, where am I speaking to you in the world at the moment?
Like so many people, I'm on lockdown in my home office in Hertfordshire.
Ah, which tees me up beautifully, because I wanted to ask you what your home setup was like. When we spoke yesterday, you mentioned you have an outdoor workspace, an outdoor office,
so to
speak. Tell me about that, because I spoke to Ian Gavin last week and he's built one in his garden and it sounds fantastic. So what does your workspace look like?
Okay, my workspace is it's known as a pod. It's by a company called Podspace in the north of England. And it's an architect who designs these things. And when I left London, I had a lovely studio in London and I didn't want to then be working in a bedroom somewhere in my house. So it was really important that I had somewhere that was very desirable to go to work and that was mine and I could be left alone to work there. It's not very big. It's 4 meters by 7 meters, but it's very comfortable. I think it's a good thing to go to work. And it's my sort of happy place in a way.
So I was doing some research after we spoke last night and I am in awe of the places that you have been and the things that you've seen, the moments that you've captured. You are a travel photographer, but not just any travel photographer. You are the winner of the prestigious Travel Photographer of the Year Award. You're also listed in Lerz's archive as one of the top 200 advertising photographers in the world. But if you are somewhere at an event, perhaps, and someone doesn't know what you do, how do you describe yourself and your work?
Good question. I suppose I would describe myself as a location photographer because it's not just travel. It's often travel related, but it can be so many other things. I travel for work. I travel to get to my work, but it's more encompassing than that. So, yeah, normally I'd say I'm a location photographer for the travel, tourism, advertising sector.
Now, you trained and completed a graphic design degree at the Norwich School of Art and Design. What prompted that decision in the first place? Did you always know you wanted to be a photographer, or did it happen organically?
Yeah, good question. I think secretly I probably always did know I wanted to be a photographer. I come from quite a creative background. My father's an artist, was an art director, so I had a very good understanding of the industry even before I got into it myself. So I was always very keen on painting and drawing and art, and I enjoyed design. I enjoyed it a lot. But at the end of my first year at art school, I had to decide what I was going to specialize in. And the idea that I'd have to really give up the amount of pictures I was taking in order to concentrate on being a good designer, I couldn't do. But I could do it the other way around. And it suited me better. It suited my temperament. I love being outside. I love adventure. And so it was an easy decision once it was made. I think a lot of people worry about the financial security of being a freelance photographer. And so I think certainly lots of people around me at the time were concerned that maybe I should just, you know, I should be, continue as a graphic designer. But I knew deep down what I really wanted to do.
So on your graphic design course, was there an element of photography within that course, or was it something you just purely did as a passion at that point?
I think up until I went to art school, I sort of self-taught, really. Up to A-level, I self-taught, my, you know, and just didn't have any tuition. And then at art school, we had the chance to do all kinds of different arts. So it would be graphic design, illustration, filmmaking, sculpture. But after the first year, they really want you to kind of buckle down and decide what your major is going to be. And so my degree is actually graphic design with a specialization within photography. Which was actually very useful because it means that when I'm working now, I'm very conscious of how typography is used in my images and how double page spreads work and how the layout can affect you know, the pictures that you take.
I see. Right. OK. So what was the transition like from leaving the graphic design course to going, right, I want to be a full time photographer. How do I do that? What was that transition like?
It's a shock, actually, because art school is a great place for bonding with, you know, making new friends and being creative and believing that you are some kind of artist or some kind of photographer. And then, of course, I, like so many, came to London and tried to get a job as an assistant. And then the dose of reality hits you quite hard. You suddenly realize, actually, you don't know that much and you've got a lot to learn. And these people take what they do incredibly seriously. And you better not let them down. So that was, I mean, and I was very lucky. I assisted some really good photographers. I only assisted for 2 years. And I was full time with Frank Hareholt and Pete Seawood. And I was freelancing with people like Malcolm Venville and Terence Donovan. So it was quite an intensive period. So the transition was at the beginning hard because I'd never known professionalism like it or the stress levels because these guys were at the sort of top of their game. And there is a lot of stress involved in those big shoots, but you learnt that you only make a mistake once. And I still look back on those days, and it's amazing for that 2 year period how much of a foundation it laid for me for the years after.
So, for anyone listening that is thinking about a career in photography, or perhaps might have even started and is wondering how to progress, how did you end up with those agencies assisting those great photographers in the first place? Did you write to people? Did you send your portfolio? Did you physically go around knocking on doors? How did that happen?
Oh, yes. Well, any way that works, really. There is no sort of golden ticket to it. I started off in a hire studio, a place called Eagle Wolf, and I started off literally just painting coves white. At the end, after a photographer would leave, I'd paint the cove again. And I did that for about 6 weeks. But there were other photographers that were based in that complex, and I just literally went knocking on their doors. And eventually, you know, I was taken in on a kind of temporary basis. I remember one of the photographers I worked for, he wanted a new second assistant, and he actually made a kind of competition between me and a much more experienced guy to see which one would get the job. And looking back, it was quite funny. The two of us were literally running around the studio trying to prove ourselves, who would get on that ladder. And that's a lot of it. It's just about showing keenness, willing to work, long hours, not a lot of money. But also, to me, I always saw it as a stepping stone, and I didn't mind what I had to do as far as, you know, hours or the kind of the highs and lows of being a photographic assistant, which, you know, everyone that's been through that period will know it well. It didn't bother me because I knew that I was learning a lot and I was with good people. They were all very talented. And I also felt then that you've got to do your time. You've got to learn because those years are really important later on.
Yeah, it's interesting. And every photographer I speak to, and I guess it's not just photography, it's every walk of life, it's persistence. And it's just keep doing what you're doing and keep learning no matter where you are and what environment you're in. Persistence seems to be the key.
Yeah, and I think also giving 110%. Don't just do what you're asked to do. Do more. And, you know, and if you don't know a bit of kit, you know, just be honest, say you don't know it, but go home and learn it that night, and so that you're ready for the next day. No one expects you to know everything, but they expect you to want to learn and to do it in your own time and use your own initiative, so that you're not just assisting that photographer. Ideally, you're bringing something new to the table as well.
So once you'd finished your training, what was your first big job when you were on your own, so to speak, sure. And you were out in the big wide world?
It's funny, I've been asked that before. There never is one kind of big job. Every job you think, this will be the one, this is going to really help my career. It that kind of success takes 20 years, that kind of overnight success. And I was very fortunate that I got an agent very early on, someone who saw something in my work. And that certainly helped get my work into advertising agencies. One of the jobs that I do remember was for Kodak. And Kodak basically asked, I think, 5 or 6 up-and-coming photographers in London at that time to shoot a campaign. And that got me a lot of publicity and won a few awards. And so that's one, sort of one rung on the ladder, if you like. But it takes a lot more than that. I was also very fortunate that I was, when I was still an assistant, I was on a shoot which was the first ever cover shoot for a new magazine for Top Gear, the car company, the car TV show. And from that, the two assistants, me and the other guy, both got offered jobs working for Top Gear as soon as we stopped being an assistant. So that was great. So that gave me work almost immediately in an editorial environment. So that was good. So I was doing editorial and trying to get advertising work at the same time.
Wow. So you were on when Top Gear started, you were there at the very start.
I was there at the beginning of the magazine. Yeah, the TV show had been going for quite a long time, but the magazine was very exciting at the time because it was brand new. And unlike a lot of the magazines at that time, they didn't have any film budgets, so we could shoot as much as we wanted. And they wanted us to be unusual. They wanted us to be experimental. And I traveled a lot like that as well, because at the beginning of my career, travel magazines as such didn't really exist. And so the best way to travel was to do drive stories for car magazines.
Now, that takes us on very nicely to your work and your career as a travel photographer. Now, I read somewhere that you have visited over 120 countries. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Quite a few. And still, hopefully, not at the moment, but hopefully we'll get back to counting a few more.
Yes, fingers crossed. So, was travel photography always part of the big picture, or was it a more organic process that you happened to have a love of travel and a love for photography, which complement one another so well?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, as a child, I was very keen on reading about explorers and adventures that they had. I very much grew up on National Geographic and those kind of magazines that were around at the time. And I knew I loved adventure. And I loved being outside. I grew up on a farm. And so that was important to me, to be able to find a lifestyle that would allow me to continue that. As far as becoming, if you like, a travel photographer, what I did was, with the first couple of years' earnings through either editorial or advertising, I went on a personal trip to Bali and Java. And that really cemented in me that this is what I want to do. And then when I got back, I was very fortunate that Condé Nast Traveler magazine had just launched. I had an exhibition, and the picture editor at the time, Caroline Metcalf, offered me my first pure travel assignment to go to the hills, the highlands of northern Thailand. And so that was really good. And so that made me think, actually, yeah, there is a job here. There is a way that I can have the adventures that I want. I can take the kind of pictures that I wanted, and somebody would pay me. That was the first time I really realized that you could be a traveling photographer without necessarily being a documentary photographer.
Now, you've touched on two really interesting things there, one of which I'm going to journey back slightly. You mentioned that you had an agent from quite early on. And for anyone listening that wants to progress their career and take it to the next level, how did you go about getting an agent? Did you approach them? Did they approach you? How did that work? And secondly, once you have an agent, what can they do to help you develop your career?
Well, yeah, on that particular occasion, a lady's name is Belle January. She's now an art buyer, but when she worked for an agent who represented one of the photographers that I assisted. And so when she was going to go out on her own, she already knew of the work that I was doing and knew of me. And I think because she was young, she wanted a young stable of photographers as well. So sometimes agents will approach you like that. But in my experience, most of the time, you approach them. And sometimes you may approach them and they may say no. And then you go back a couple of years later. Just because they say no doesn't mean they're not watching your progress and the work that you're doing. And then to answer your other question, as far as what does an agent do? For me, agents are very good about getting your work in front of the right people that commission, certainly within advertising. And they're also very good at dealing with the production side of it, whether it's organizing usage agreements or bringing in production companies, location scouts. If you're on a very large shoot, you cannot do it on your own. And in fact, you shouldn't. It's much better to concentrate on the photography aspect of it and let other people worry about the logistics. Of course, you're involved in it and you know what's going on, but actually your time is better spent doing what you're good at.
And you also mentioned that when you returned from your trip to Bali and Java, you had an exhibition.
Yes.
Is that something that you organised? Where was that? And from the body of work that you had, how did you decide what images you would display in that exhibition?
Sure. Okay. So when I came back, I was also friends with some guys that owned a retouching house in London, and they had recently moved and they had a big empty space they didn't know what to do with. And just over conversation, they said, we can have an exhibition here if you wish. And that was great for me because I couldn't have afforded it any other way. And it's good to do. Exhibitions are good, but they are a costly affair. You know, you have to pay for all the prints yourself. You dream that you'll sell some. Quite often you don't sell any. But it's about building the exposure, inviting the right people. I think when people do an exhibition, they think it's a failure if they haven't sold or, you know, many images. It's not just about that. It's about just letting people know you're there and letting them have the time and space to look at your work and have a chat with you.
How long did that particular exhibition last?
I think it was about 4 to 6 weeks, something like that. And it did work really well for me. It also, for me, allowed me to look at the travel work I'd been doing up until that point. As I said, I went to Bali and Java, but I always have done personal work. And I always travel every year somewhere just for myself. That's not an assignment. And 20 years later, I still do that now. And I think that's really important to go and do work that's not commissioned. I mean, I still set myself a brief and I still very much have an idea of the emotion I want to create when I go somewhere. But it allows you to go off target a little bit, off brief. And that can be quite exciting as a photographer because you can discover things new.
This kind of beautifully leads on to my next question, actually, which was, you mentioned then that you still travel for yourself. What extent do you plan those trips and where you want to go? Is everything mapped out or do you tend to go off-piste? How long do you go for?
Over the years, I've done all different ones, really. And in the beginning, I would go to places to prove to myself that I could do it. So I wanted to be able to work in very cold environments. So funnily enough, I trained in an Asda cold store in Dartford for a few hours for about six weeks. I wanted to know how cameras behave at that kind of temperatures, that the oil in lenses freeze, and I was shooting on film in those days. If you use a motor drive, it becomes brittle and snaps. And so a lot of the early sort of trips that I did were for me to test myself and to learn. How do you work in jungles? How do you work in deserts? So how do you work in the Arctic? So a lot of them were for that reason. Now, as far as how much research I do, I'm always researching. So it's not, you know, you can tell me anywhere and I can tell you something about it, you know. So it's an ongoing thing. I keep scrapbooks, I keep mood boards of things that I like all the time. And then, of course, if I'm doing an assignment, then we'll do a lot of research and I'll often work either with the agency or with the writers, if it's a magazine. And we do a fair amount of research to plan the route. I'll also do a lot of picture research. I want to know what people have shot before. And then I want to be able to sometimes shoot that because it's like a safety net to have those images first. But then I want to see a different angle. I want to find something new. The other reason I would do a lot of picture research is that I can then show a guide who may not speak English as his first language the kind of thing I'm after. And visual things are much better to do that than to try and explain it. And so I'll always create a mood board as well. So I may not know, for example, let's say I go to Casablanca in Morocco. I may not know Casablanca, but I would have studied a kind of mood, a color palette, and the kind of emotions that I want to create from that shoot, much more than the actual destinations themselves.
I love that you spent, from all of that, I enjoyed that you spent 6 weeks in Asda. Which Asda were you in?
Dartford.
Dartford, Asda. Yeah, so did you go in?
Me and a pack of lots of pizzas.
So did you go in after hours and then?
No, it was quite funny. A friend of mine was quite high up in the management there, and I would literally just walk through the canteen in full Arctic clothing once a week, and just with my cameras, and just sit in there and take pictures of pizza boxes, because they thought I was crazy, but I didn't want to get to an environment and not know what was going to happen. I learned a lot.
How long did you spend in each sitting?
About two or three hours at about minus 25.
Wow. Well, I just think it's fascinating that level of, I guess it's that level of preparation, like you say, because you don't want to get there and miss the shot because...
Well, exactly. And I think because I was learning, I mean, I've obviously been to a lot of very cold places since then, but those things that you learn in the first couple of trips that you do, you know, like you were saying earlier, you don't make the same mistake twice. I don't want to be able to not get the shot, but also... When I'm asked to go somewhere, my first thoughts after the initial excitement of great as a job is what could go wrong there? And I work back from what could go wrong and then try to make sure that I'm prepared. So that, you know, if you go somewhere very cold, for example, cable releases shrink. The cables get tighter and they fall. So you must make sure you've got lots of spare cable releases or different ways of doing it. Use old manual ones or use your self-timer. You have to learn those things, and you kind of sometimes you learn them the hard way by them going wrong. Same as taking cameras into humid jungle environments. The moisture, certain cameras that are not well weather sealed will just stop working within maybe half an hour. And so a lot of the cameras that I use are designed for sports photographers because they're designed to be set out on the edge of a football field in the rain for 90 minutes. So I use kit that I know is tough enough to take it. And it's the same with wherever you go, you have to learn a little bit about that environment.
Is that Asda experience, I don't want to fixate on the fact that you're in Asda whilst it is absolutely brilliant, it's the level of preparation that I find fascinating. Is that the most extreme preparation that you've done prior to going on a trip?
Yeah, probably. And I think it's because I was so young as well. I was probably only... 24, 25 then, and I really was eager to see the world as quickly as I could.
Let's move on, if I may, to talk about Travel Photographer of the Year. What was the journey like getting to that point? Had you applied for the competition before in previous years, and how did you decide what images you would submit?
Had I applied before? I'd applied every year for 12 years since it began. it was a competition I really wanted to win. I felt like it was designed for people like me, the kind of work that I do. And for 11 years, I'd won other awards, single awards or category awards, but I'd never won the main overall prize. So that was a relief to start with, that I was kind of doing the right thing. But also, as far as the images go, there were two sets. To win it outright, you have to win two categories. And so I had a set of images from Namibia of a woman on the Himba tribe on the Angola border. And I had another set of images from a place called Lalibela, which is a place of pilgrimage and worship in Ethiopia. And I think both of them told stories in a set of pictures. And they were done... in a short period of each other. So as in the Himba shots were literally done in 1 hour, one early morning. And so they have a continuity of tone and color and light. And I think that's often what they're looking for. They're looking for something which not only resonates with the judges, but as a package tells a story. One image alone wouldn't win it. It has to be that all of them collectively have a bigger strength because of the way they work with each other.
So for anyone that doesn't know the competition, how many images do you submit per year?
I would normally submit about, well, I try as many as you can afford, really, but it's not the most expensive competition. I would probably put in about 15 pictures, maybe, each year. And they may be, some of them will be individual pictures and some of them would be a series. But if you want to win, it's a series that you've got to get through, which is harder because you may have three amazing pictures and one weak one, and then that won't get through. And even if you've got one amazing one, the best you'll ever get will be best single image. So I'm always looking to get the stories. But I don't shoot pictures thinking that will be good for an award. And both of those two that won the award were both on assignment. So they were for a commission in the first place.
When you're deciding which 15 images you're going to submit, how do you settle on those 15 images? I mean, do you show family? Do you show friends? Do you put them out into the world to get feedback? How did you decide on those 15 images?
I think I mainly do it myself, to be honest, but I go through quite a long process, the same as when I come back and edit from a shoot. I'll use a software like Bridge to start with, and I find one image that really resonates with me and feel that is the linchpin, if you like, of the story. And then I'll put all the other images next to it and say, does it help it? Does it make it weaker? Is it saying the same thing? And so I go through quite a long process. I will then do small prints, working prints, maybe just like, you know, 5x4 inches, and I lay them out on the floor and just see how the color tones work together. So it is quite a long process. And I think it's important as well that you walk away from it for a few days and then go back, because then sometimes you know, what was I doing? That doesn't work, or that you've missed a picture. Sometimes the best picture isn't the one for the right series. It may have been a struggle to get. It may have, you know, you may have thought it was fantastic at the time. When you see it as a set for an award, it's a different thing. It's the same as when you're doing a commission. It's not always the best picture photographically that gets used. It's the one that tells the story, that's got the narrative that will be used. So I do, you know, ask you a question. Do I ask other people? Sometimes, but I'm pretty self-critical.
What's your journey like from the moment you take the card out of the camera to delivering what you feel is your final image? What does that journey look like? You mentioned Bridge. What's your workflow? I guess it's
okay. Yeah, I understand. It varies depending on the job. I prefer shooting to card rather than shooting tethered, as in straight into a laptop, only because I'm quite active and I like moving around a lot. I don't really want the restraints of a cable. But sometimes when you're shooting advertising and it's going straight into a layout, so we'll have the layout on the computer so the art director can see the image coming in and knows that it will fit and that the typography will work around it. And lots of people on those big shoots will have an opinion and they all want to come and have a look at the monitor while you're shooting. So that is one way of working, which I have to do that for advertising. And it's I don't mind it. It's more of a collaborative process. But when I'm doing more sort of editorial or more sort of geographical work, then my workflow would be shoot to card. I don't back up. Some people shoot to two cards at the same time. I don't. I shoot to one card. I try not to use really large cards. Maybe 64 gig cards, so that I can change them on a fairly regular basis, so that if a card does corrupt, you haven't lost everything. I shoot a card all day long. I've got a lot of cards. And mainly I don't put them onto a computer in the daytime because we're traveling, we're too busy, or we're recce-ing for the next location. So each night in a hotel, I will put them all onto a laptop, and then I back it up into at least two other places. So in theory, it's in three places, everything I shoot. It's on the laptop and then two other external hard drives. I don't tend to go through and edit while I'm away. I'll go and check focus, make sure there's no damage on lenses and or there's no sensor dust and that kind of thing. But I don't tend to edit as I go. And the reason that I don't is because I don't want to believe I've got it. I don't want to think I've got that now, move on. I still want to remain hungry. And so I'll go through and go, yeah, that's okay. We know that it's good, but none of them are that good. So the next day you go out and you try to still think you've got nothing. So I will then put up, say, two hard drives. And then when I get three places, one on the laptop as well, when I get back to my office, it will go onto a RAID system again in two places, one kept off site and one kept in my office. Then from there, I'll go through in Lightroom and tag all the usable pictures that I think are good. And when I first see pictures, when I first come back, I never like them. There's always too much, because in order to get to a picture, there's a process that I go through. And you'll see, you know, if you were to look at a timeline of my images, especially if I'm in a city or something, every fifth picture is of the road. And that's because I'm using it as a meter gauge. So it's a good sort of 19% grey tarmac, or you'll see a picture of the back of my hand where I can see the watch, so I know what time of day I shot it and what time to go back. So there's lots of stuff in there in the process which I don't want to see then. So I edit it down to all the usable ones. I export them as JPEGs, and then I take those into Bridge and I start tagging each one. I store them as day in each day, and each day gets broken down to an AM and a PM because that's the time I work nearly always, very early in the morning and late in the afternoon, evening. I don't tend to work much in the middle of the day unless it's maybe interiors or portraits. And that's just because of the kind of light that I like. I like a very low angle light. So yeah, then I go through and process it in Bridge. And once I've got those right, then there normally be, let's say, a 10-day shoot would get down to maybe 100 pictures, and probably from about 8,000 to about 100 pictures. And then that's what would get sent to my client, as well as a folder of my personal favorites in as well, so that they know how I was feeling and thinking at the time.
I love the level of detail that you go to on a shoot, and that, you know, you're almost leaving breadcrumbs for yourself the entire way through, that when you get to the edit process, you've got reminders, like you said, you've got AM, you've got PM, it might be tarmac and a road.
Yeah.
And the level of detail.
I also would take pictures of street signs to remember where I am. And it's the same as in the old days, sports photographers would, like, every fifth frame take a picture of the scoreboard, so that the photo editors, when they got it back, knew at what point in the game those pictures were taken. And okay, that was done before metadata and, you know, cameras have all that information inside. But for me, I need to be able to add all that data when I get back. So I do need to know where I was. But I do find when I'm editing, it is literally like taking the picture again. I'm going through and saying to myself, look left, there's something left. Did I look left? And then, I did. So that worked. You know, editing takes the same amount of time as taking them to me.
Yeah, I interviewed someone a few weeks ago and they said, photography is half the job, the edit is the other half. And you've got to love both equally.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like it equally, but I much prefer to be out there taking the pictures. But, you know, once you have got down to your sort of top 10 favorites from a shoot, then you start to think, okay, yeah, now that's okay, it works. But there's always that nervous bit when you're going through, and maybe you got to day 9 and you still haven't seen any good light on a 10-day shoot. And you're just thinking, how much can I do in that last day to make that, to salvage that work?
Do you remember where you were when you look at an image? So what I mean,
most
is,
of the time, yes, yes.
it's one of the things I love about photography, because without realizing it, I can look back at a photograph from 6-7 years ago and think, oh wow, I was there and I had so and so with me, and I remember doing this later that evening. And for some reason, there's a clarity when you look at an image. Do you feel that?
Images that some of my images I've seen a lot, you know, so they get out there more than others. So those, you know. But when I'm going back through a drive that has the whole shoot on, and I'm looking at day 4 a.m., I'm actually walking that street again, and I'm going through, and I remember everything then about it. Yeah, for sure.
I could talk to you all day for hours on end about travel, but I'm conscious of your time. So let's move on, if that's all right, to how you came into the top 200 advertising photographers worldwide on Lerza's archive.
Well, that comes about quite simply by submitting images every year. And then you hope eventually that you get enough votes that you get to that level. But it's something you have to keep up every year. And that's just about, there's lots of awards out there. Some are worth doing, some are not. Some will give you great publicity, some don't. They just cost you a lot of money to enter. So it's just picking the right ones that you're going to be a part of, because you could literally just spend all your time and all your income just entering awards. And awards are good, but they're part of what you should do as a photographer, and you shouldn't put so much weight on it, really. But it is, those sort of badges are good for other people to use for you.
Is there one out there that has eluded you so far?
Oh, there's lots. and even if you've won one once, you do question whether it was a bit of a fluke. Can you do it again? And nobody wants to think that their best work was behind them. So you keep trying. I mean, I enter probably less awards now than I have done in the past, but some of that depends on the commissions that you're getting at the time. Certain kind of commissions or certain travels that you do will be very good for awards, and others will suit your client perfectly, but may not be an award type image.
So is there, you said that you felt like Travel Photographer of the Year was the one for you. Is there, and you chuckled when I said, is there any that have eluded you? Is there one? Is there another one up there?
I wouldn't mind a Sony Award. That would be pretty good. Siena Awards. There are lots. But I wouldn't lose any sleep over not getting it. But it's a great recognition within the industry if you do.
Why photography? And I know that is extremely broad. I ask because for me, it's twofold. It's firstly what I said earlier about you can look at an image and it brings back a rush of memories and emotions. And secondly, you can never take the same photograph twice. You could have the same camera in the same location at the same time of day and two photographers would take a completely different image. Why photography?
I suppose I got my first camera when I was 13 and it instantly felt right. It fit my hand. I still love the kit as much as I did then. It just suits my personality, I guess, and my patience levels. Having studied art and tried to draw and paint, being a son of a painter, I know how difficult that is. And I think that photography for me as well gives me an excuse to explore. And the two go hand in hand to me. I think if I was, if I was just taking pictures in a room or in a studio environment every day, that to me would be a job. But with the work that I do, and I've been fortunate enough to do up until now, it's a way of life. And to me, to live a photographic life that involves travel, adventure, you know, and new things I've never done before, places I've never been, that and photography all go hand in hand. You can't take one away from the other. And I'm also doing a lot of filming now as well. And it's just, I get the same buzz when I'm doing video as I am when I'm doing stills. It's just sometimes there's more people involved. So it's a creative process. And when I decided that I was going to be a photographer and not a designer, without doubt, the best decision I ever made in my life. You know, it's given me such a great excuses to have some, you know, really fun times.
Do you take a camera everywhere with you? Within
not
reason,
any, yeah, not anymore. Mainly with having a family, they know that if I take a camera with me, I'm working, and they're like, you know, can't you just look, Daddy? You know, so I do take cameras out a lot, but not every day anymore. But I used to, but now no. But I can't imagine traveling without one. So on holiday, yes, I do take cameras.
Of all the places that you've traveled to and worked in, is there one that stands out amongst the others? Is there somewhere that you think, wow, that was really quite something?
Yeah, good question. No, you tend to remember a place by the quality of the work that you produced to start with. So I've been to places where I might not have had a great time, but if the images were worked out well, then you remember it. I mean, I remember going to Haiti, and that was a crazy idea. It was a travel magazine. Somebody had convinced an editor that Haiti was going to be the new Havana. Of course, I arrived in the island of Haiti in the Caribbean, only to discover they were pretty much in civil war. And it was a very tough assignment. And I don't think I particularly enjoyed it much, but it changed me. It made me realize that humanity is not quite as good and golden as we think it is, and that there are people that are really struggling out there. And as a traveling photographer, you must be aware of that, because there's always a danger that you just put a gloss on everything. And the same, you know, I'm very influenced by painting as well. And when a lot of Victorian painters would go and make these places, it was a very colonial view of those places. And you have to be very careful that you, when you go somewhere, that you're showing it the best you can, but also with dignity to the people that are there. So Haiti is one I do remember very strongly. And I suppose others, I mean, the first time you ever go to India is mind blowing. And the first time, you know, you're in a Sahara desert in the middle of nowhere, haven't seen anyone for 6 days. Those kind of things, you know, leave a mark on you.
Is there somewhere that you, I'm sure there's a long, long list. Is there somewhere that you want to go to that you haven't explored yet?
There's a lot of places. Funnily enough, I've never been to Mozambique and I've never been to the Philippines, and they're both high up on my list to go. There's lots of other places as well which I'd like to go to when maybe the world's a kinder place. Afghanistan, I'd love to go to the mountains in Afghanistan. I'd like to go. I haven't been to Pakistan either. So there's a lot to see. But I also really enjoy going back to places and seeing how they've changed. I first went to Cuba 22 years ago, and I was back again there last year. I've been a few times in between. And the changes are enormous. And in Cuba's case, very much in a good way. But then also I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, in Syria and in Lebanon, and in, you know, those places have changed a lot, and not always for the better.
It's interesting that you say Cuba has changed, because I went to Cuba 4 years ago maybe, and it's the first time I'd visited, and it's lost in time almost when you arrive. You know, there's the old cars, there's the old buildings. What had changed in the time between the first time you went and your most recent visit?
I think they're more comfortable in their own skin to start with. I think the political system is a lot calmer. But when I first went 22 years ago, there were old cars, but that was because there was no choice. The difference now is that these old cars are being rebuilt with modern engines in for tourism, and they're realizing now that if you take the old Havana away, then people won't come. It's a big pull for tourism to be able to, you know, to drive along those beachfront roads in old Cadillacs. And of course, the other thing that's changed a lot is that lots of people have been coming back to Cuba that exiled for many years. And so they're bringing influences back. And when I first went, the food was appalling because everything was exported. And now they're really starting to fall in love again with their local Cuban cuisine. And that is amazing. And it's really refreshing to see. And they seem to be finding their own voice on their own terms, which is always, I think, has longevity for a destination.
As a traveling photographer, what's the most important item that you travel with in your kit bag? Is there something you simply cannot live without?
Apart from the obvious,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, every job I pack slightly differently for. The one thing I do use a lot is a viewfinder, an LCD viewfinder. And I don't know many other photographers that use it like I do, but it's basically a blacked out viewfinder, which has a magnetic clip that clips onto the back of your LCD on your camera. And it allows me to look at the picture without any other interruptions around me. And also I'm working often in very bright places. And so it allows me to really concentrate on the image just for a few seconds to see, you know, how it worked, did it work? And it's a very good tool for showing it to other people as well, art directors, clients, or sometimes a subject that you're photographing. So I would say, yeah, the LCD viewfinders is something I'd miss. I could work without it, but it's come part of the way that I like to work.
If there was only one image that you could frame to put in your office, what would it be?
Yes, you sent me this question and I've been thinking about that. It wouldn't be a recent picture, actually. It would be one that I took very early on of a young novice monk boy in a place called the Lama Yuru Temple in Ladakh, which is the Indian Himalayas. I think every few years you take a picture which surprises you. And I always love those pictures. You know, you kind of think, did I take that? That's too good for me. And then there's something about it which leads you on to your next few years of what you're doing. And that was the first one I ever took when I brought it back and thought, that's got a painterly feel. It doesn't answer all the questions. It's geographical. And all the things that I really liked about, you know, images. So that one would be the one, but it was shot a long time ago. It was shot, I think, in 1998. So I had a few more moments like that since, but it was at the beginning, and so it feels special to me.
If someone had £50 to spend to improve their photography, how would you advise they spend it?
Presuming they already have a camera, if you're only spending £50 on one, probably use your phone. £50, I would suggest that you either buy foot or buy bicycle. Go somewhere you've never been before and take a camera and explore.
What's the ultimate goal? I mean, presumably
the ultimate goal.
Travel photographer of the year was definitely up there, but is there another goal going forward?
Yeah, to continue doing what I'm doing as much as I can, and for only ever to stop when I decide.
I think that might be the perfect answer to that question. Now, I'm going to ask you a series of quick fire questions, and I'm going to hold you to an answer. So, black and white or colour?
Colour.
I think I know the answer to this next one. studio or natural light?
Daylight outside.
Canon or Nikon or other?
Any. But I mainly use Canons for stills and Blackmagic for video.
Ah, now that's interesting. How do you find the Blackmagic?
Brilliant. Yeah, I've got the 6K pocket, and as a bit of kit for what it costs and everything else, it's an amazing quality, and I think it's a very good jump for stills photographers to use. I think it's very intuitive the way it works.
We haven't really touched on the video side of your work. How did that happen? Was it something that you'd always had a passion for, and photography kind of steered you into it?
It started with when I was doing a lot of work with Land Rover. I'd go off and have all these adventures, and we'd go to the Sahara, or we'd go and follow the monsoon rains across India, or we'd go to Libya for the total eclipse. And I went and did all these things, and we started making these behind the scenes films, really just for us to start off with, just as a bit of fun. And our clients saw them and loved them and said, well, could you on the next one, make it 50-50 and do as much video as you do stills? And that was 15 years ago. And sort of since then, I've been doing more video. It's got to the point now on probably about 50% of what I do is video, but nearly always it's in conjunction with stills as well. They want me to do both, because it's cost effective and it's one person's vision as well. So I've always done it, but over the last couple of years, I've sort of upped the way that I do it. Not so much just shooting on DSLRs, but trying to shoot on other cameras as well, and to work with other teams. So working with sound artists or editors, graders. Not trying to sort of think I can do it all myself, and I know I can't. So it's much better to be a collaborative thing. So no, I enjoy it, but I think that a lot of the videos, in a way, look like my stills, and that's the way that I see things. But I love bringing in sound effects and music as well. I think it's another way to tell a story.
Prime or Zoom?
Given a choice, Prime always, but that doesn't always happen. I'm very limited on what I can carry. There's so much kit that I'd like to take to places, but literally when if I might be somewhere on my own, or even if I'm with an assistant, that's literally just two rucksacks. And also speed. So I think when I started, you'd never use a zoom lens. It would always have to be primes, because zoom lenses weren't very good. They're a lot better now, and the quality is really good. But there's something about the decision process when you work with primes that actually puts you in a stronger position to take pictures. If you're working on primes, you learn a lot more about composition when you're starting, and it makes you engage with your subject a lot more. And unless you're shooting wildlife, and I wouldn't suggest you use the 50mm prime. But I like the quality of some of the prime lenses that are out there now. You talked about Nikon and Canon. I mean, I think they've both got good prime lenses, and so Sigma, the Art series, they're very good too. And also, I've been experimenting recently with Cine lenses as well, and they make stills lenses look cheap.
Yeah, they really are. They're quite something, those Cine lenses. Film or digital?
After so many years arguing at airports with X-ray machine guys, it's got to be digital.
Ah, now this will be an interesting one for you. People or landscapes?
Oh. People, I suppose, if I had to make that decision. Yeah, probably. I mean, eventually, it's a bit like being on a desert island disc, isn't it? Eventually, you'd go crazy if you were just looking at a landscape. At least people react.
Do you have a preference in terms of shooting rather than the desert island discs scenario where you're looking at a landscape? Or
people? No, honestly. I mean, I think what happens with landscapes is that, one, the destination may be outstanding already, and you're always looking for good locations, but light can change so fast, and if you get an understanding of daylight and how it can work, then it can suddenly bring something magical which you weren't expecting. And it's all about knowing when you're being lucky, really, and to sort of monopolize that situation. And with people, people can sometimes surprise you. You think they're not going to give you what you what you want, or they're not going to be very easy to photograph, and then you get that spark of excitement and it all comes together. Just going back a little bit to the Himba woman that I photographed for Travel Photographer of the Year, that was an unusual shoot, because it was a collaboration between me and the girl I was photographing. She lives in a literally in a mud hut in Namibia, but she's very much aware of her sort of herself. And so I would show her in the back of the camera the pictures we were taking, and she would readjust her jewelry and would take some more. And I love that collaboration. I think that it's much better to feel like you're making a picture rather than taking.
That's interesting, actually. How do you go about working with somebody that potentially doesn't feel 100% comfortable in front of the camera, and it's your job to make them feel at ease?
It is. Body language is really important, and I think that you can often read into that. The other thing, of course, is that sometimes you don't want them to react. Depending on what you're trying to say about that person, maybe the awkwardness is what you need. Sometimes people that immediately smile and give you the perfect smile every time actually don't give you anything. They give you a facade. So sometimes you put people at ease because that's the look that you want, depending on what you're doing. Other times you don't. You leave it like it is. The other thing I do is I use a lot of sort of sign language, and I can get them to sort of pay attention to me, even if there's lots of other people around. And that's often the hardest thing, is when you've got lots of other people watching you take pictures and your subject is looking at them all the time. And you need to command that space. If they're nervous, you can't be. You've got to look like you know what you're doing.
Landscape or portrait? I ask because for some reason I tend to take a lot more landscape images than portrait. I don't know why, but just seem to be the way my eye works. Do you have a preference?
I don't really. It depends on the subject. And I suppose because of my graphic design training, I always shoot both. So if I'm doing a landscape, let's say, and it's in a landscape format, I'll always do it in a portrait single page version as well. That's sort of habit for me. I always do that. People are very different. If you're doing a portrait format tends to work better, but then sometimes you've got to break those rules and stick them in the corner of a frame on a landscape format, and that can bring attention as well. So no, I don't have a preference. In fact, I started on Hasselblad, so I started on square. So and even now I shoot a landscape, put it onto Instagram, it changes it immediately.
I think it's really interesting there that you mentioned something about you always have an eye for where the image is going. And I think that's so important nowadays, because
I think totally. I think if you're going to try and work really hard to get a good picture, it's got to be usable. Otherwise, you're the equivalent of a bedroom guitarist. You know, you might be a genius, but if nobody ever hears you play. And it's the same thing. I think that if when I'm taking a picture and I want it to be a cover, or I really want the art director to think about it as a cover, I try to make it as easy for them as possible. There's no point having a picture as a commercial photographer if it's not usable.
Now, that's again, we've touched on something that I hadn't really planned on, actually, but it's I think it's fascinating because that's where the business side comes in as well, isn't it? You have to understand your whole business. And I spoke to another photographer who said, I'm delivering something for someone else to do their job, and I have to think of it like that. Despite my natural urges sometimes to take the best shot, I think
eventually what happens, well, certainly what's happened for me, is that it's so ingrained in me when I'm working that even when I'm doing one of my self-initiated projects, I'm still thinking about how it can be used in a magazine or how it could be used as an ad. Where's the space for copy and the type? I think it's so ingrained in me. I don't think I could take that out of my mind. I don't sort of take pictures for an exhibition. I don't take them for that purpose. They all have a reason for being taken. And I would like, I'd like to see my pictures used.
If someone wanted a career in photography, what advice would you give them?
Never give up. It's hard at times. I would tell them to not always believe everything you see. Photographers are good at making things look good, especially their own careers, and so follow your own road and be different. We're so many images around these days, especially, social media and everything else. Everyone can make an image. Not everyone can tell a story and have their own personal stamp on it. And that takes time. You can't go out straight away and just think that's going to be, an image that people will know I've taken. It takes time to know the kind of things that you like. So explore, experiment, be different. Work hard and don't accept failure.
Philip Lee Harvey, I think that is a wonderful way to finish. Don't accept failure.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you ever so much.
Appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Philip Lee Harvey. A huge thank you to Philip for taking the time to share his incredible journey with us. If you'd like to find out more about Philip, you can find him on Instagram at Philip_Lee_Harvey @Philip_photographer. Did you get all that? Once again, it's @Philip_Lee_Harvey_photographer, and that is Philip with one L. Or visit his website, www.philipleeharvey.com. If you enjoy the Standout Photography Show, please subscribe and download future episodes on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can find the time to leave us a 5-star review, we would absolutely love to hear what you think of the show and what you'd like to hear more of in future. For now, thank you once again for joining us. I've been Matthew Walker. He has been Philip Lee Harvey. And you have been sensational. Until next time. Take care. Who built your website, incidentally?
Well, I designed it.
Right.
And so what actually happened is it's a company called Byte that actually I worked with on it. But I worked out the layout and how I wanted it to look myself.
It's lovely. I love the simplicity of when you first go on.
Yeah, that was very much the case. What happens with websites, I think, is that you keep adding to it and you forget to take things off. And before you know where you are, it's a mess. And I kind of, the analogy I use is when you first move into your new house or it's just been redecorated, you think this is really nice. And then you just fill it with stuff. Thank you. I wanted it to be the bare essentials to what you need.
How did you go about deciding the images that you wanted on the website? Because again, I spoke to another photographer last week and their website must have only contained 20 images maybe.
Right.
And there's, you know, 20 years worth of work. And I was like, how did you arrive at these 20 images?
I tend to put on ones that often they're quite current. So the ones that I've done recently, or they're just ones that we're in discussions with my agents and everything else, feel that it's a good image to represent what I do. I also have the added bonus in a way that I have an archive on my site as well. So if you wanted to find more, there's a lot more there.
Oh, I see. So you've got a stock archive, which I noticed. Yes. Kind of in the background, so to speak.
Yes. Yes. And so if people, rather than flooding with my images, maybe, for example, I could do a whole website just on Safari or a whole thing just literally on one country. So the way I get around that is, and also I've been quite prolific over the years. And so I put that into the archive. So it's still available for people to find if they want and they can search from it.
I see. How's work been in the current environment?
Well, or lack of absolutely no work. I had a very busy year planned. It was all looking really good, but then, you know, like, not just me, so many of people, you know, the tap got turned off. We'll come back, and hopefully we'll come back to a better world, you know. So I think that we have to learn from this. I've still got a lot to do in the office. You know, I'm still updating the archive and finishing some film edits off. Then once I've done all that, I'll start again and start thinking of where I'd like to go, mood boards and the next thing, really.
Have you thought about ways that you might work differently going forward because of the current environment?
Yeah, I'd like to be not so stressed. But, you know, the stress comes from others most of the time. So I'd like the whole industry to not be so stressed. But, you know, the advertising world is notoriously, you know, stressful and quite last minute. And I think it doesn't need to be like that. I think it's just the way people have become.
Yeah, it seems to be getting more last minute as well. I don't know whether you've noticed that.
Yeah, no, it does. I think with me, I don't get it that bad because it's very difficult to do a last minute trip to somewhere. You know, but it does happen. You know, sometimes I get a couple of days notice and I have to go. But most of the time I get a bit more than that. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what happens when we do go back. I hope that a lot of the tourist boards and hotels and people in the travel world realize that quality will last and influencers don't tell stories.
What, in terms of Instagram influencers?
In terms of when you look through Instagram or you look through a lot of hotel tourist board feeds, now they've there seemed to be a very easy way for them to get a lot of free content, which was to give free hotel rooms to influencers with a lot of followers who aren't necessarily photographers. And they all put on the same kind of preset, so they all look the same. And it's often a picture of them or their partner standing by a pool. The problem with those kind of images is that they all look the same. You can literally go through so much of that travel work on Instagram, and you couldn't tell who shot it. They all start to buy into the same presets, and there is no room for presets in my mind in photography. There, you know, every picture deserves its own way of being worked on.
Yeah, I agree.
So I hope that, you know, and you may have two million followers. Will that turn around into sales? You know, are these pictures usable in multiple formats? You know, can you crop into them at 200% and still use it as an A4? Those sort of things are really important for longevity. If you're giving a hotel resort or a tourist board images, they want them to last a long time and to build a brand that's theirs and not a generic brand. And I think that they need to look more closely about what they're trying to say rather than believing numbers are enough.
Interestingly, because this is something that I spoke to another photographer, not on the show, just in general, he lives over the road. We were just discussing exactly what you've just said about Instagram. And years ago, if you handed over a selection of images, you said these are usable for 6 months, 12 months. And yeah, that was fine because they were in a magazine or they were going on a billboard. Whereas now they and also territories as well have just completely yeah. changed with the internet. How do you go about
policing it?
I didn't want to use the word policing, but putting it in contract.
Things have changed. I remember the first time people would say to me, "We want it for web use, UK only." And it's like, well, that doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, because there are no borders.
It's a worldwide thing. As far as my images go, and I've read a lot about this, I heard a lot of people saying about, you know, should you put your images on social media? Are you giving them their copyright away? I don't worry about that. If people wanted to steal a picture, they could go to my website and re-photograph it. They could screen grab it. They could do all kinds of stuff if they want to get hold of it. You can't do much about that. If my images get used on Instagram, somebody takes it and this does happen fairly often when people say, "We love Philip's picture shot in Kenya. Why don't you try one of our Safari programs out?" And they think that by just crediting you, that's okay. But to me, it's not okay because I'm an endorsement to their product and they're getting free advertising. So I would normally say there, I just send them a message saying, take it down or pay me. And they go away. They go pretty quickly. Most people don't want to get involved in that. There's a whole bunch of image recognition software that stock libraries use to track illegal use of your work. Again, normally when my stuff gets used, I see it. Or somebody sees it, you'd have to rip out all the metadata, which people do, of course. It's not that difficult. But I think that there are too many, there's too many battles to fight. And I think unless I thought that it was a multinational company, I don't worry about it too much. I think that, you know, people could always steal work. People could always buy a book of someone's work, take a picture of it, stick it in their portfolio. That sort of stuff's always, you know, could go on. But it wouldn't really do anyone any favors. But I think that and the fact that most of the pictures you're uploading to Instagram are such low resolution anyway. And I think that you have to accept that you're putting stuff up there because you want people to see it. And if it gets reposted out a dozen times, well, you know, a lot of people would like that.
I think
the only times I would take people to court is if it's used in a derogatory fashion, which, you know, has happened on a couple of occasions where they you know, credited me for a picture to do with something which was that model or that person was nothing about. And I think that crosses a line then when you're using it in a journalistic way about, let's say, I don't know, female abuse or, you know, something like that. Then, you know, you can't have your pictures of somebody in the Himba tribe being used like that. Then would come down hard. But the rest of the time, no, I just let most of it go.